Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the roots of a rockabye baby song may go deeper than we realize. We'll learn about a new theory on how lullabies evolved with Gemma Tarlack of Discover Magazine.
First, state assembly Republicans shared their transportation funding plan last week. The complex plan involves cutting the existing gas tax while applying the state sales tax to fuel purchases. On Friday, we talked to a reporter about the details of the plan. You can hear the archived audio of that interview at WPR.org/Central Time.
Since the plan has been released, there's been a lot of reaction. Governor Scott Walker told the Associated Press that he can't support the Republicans' plan. And the Wisconsin State Journal released an editorial called Just Raise the Gas Tax Already. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Scott Milford joins us now. He's the editorial page director for the Wisconsin State Journal. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, make the case. Why just raise the gas tax already?
Well, the cost of roads is not getting any cheaper. And in fact, the gas tax that we have been paying is going down. Every year, our cars get better gas mileage. So that means, according to, say, the Fiscal Bureau, the nonpartisan Fiscal Bureau, which crunches numbers for the state, the average driver in Wisconsin is actually burning 48 fewer gallons a year. And that means we're spending about $15 less a year on the gas tax. The gas tax has not been raised in more than a decade, and it doesn't go up when the price of gas goes up because it's tied to the price per gallon. So for some reason, the governor has decided that this is a terrible, onerous tax, and it cannot be raised no matter what. But in reality, it's not. It hasn't been going up. But the cost of roads are going up, and we're expanding roads, and we're a tourism state that needs good roads. We're an economy that needs good roads, and I don't understand why a simple fee increase on motorists is so onerous or so difficult, especially when other fees are going up. We have to pay more to go into a state park. We have to pay more for licenses that we get, things like that. So we also have to pay more for roads, because inflation keeps going up. And this is one of the few things that hasn't increased. And for some reason, the governor, I think, politically, and he's a smart guy when it comes to politics, thinks that this is where he's going to draw a line and not allow it to go up. But in the meantime, our roads are deteriorating. We just had a state audit that said we have the worst roads in the Midwest, and they're getting worse because we don't have money. And U.S. News and World Report just ranked our roads as 49th out of 50 states. To get by, the governor has been borrowing a lot of money, almost $1 billion in each of his last two budgets. But I think lawmakers, particularly in the assembly, understand that this is unsustainable and it can't continue, and we need to get some more revenue from somewhere.
So let's look at this assembly plan, because you're right, they are trying to borrow less than the governor is to do the same amount of work. So they've got this mechanism lowering the gas tax, but putting the gas tax on the sales tax that applies for everything else, some other fiscal maneuvers, and then ultimately changing the income tax to kind of balance that out. What's wrong with their plan?
Well, it's very convoluted. It has even more pieces than you're mentioning.
Right.
It probably has another 10 pieces than you're mentioning. And there's a lot of it that doesn't even deal with the gas tax. I mean, I think there's some decent ideas in there. I think that asking the federal government if we can put some tolling, open road tolling, not the kind of tolling that makes you stop all the time, but if we could have tolling on the interstates, we could bring in more revenue from, say, Illinois tourists or from over-the-road truck drivers. I think repealing the minimum markup on gasoline isn't a bad idea, but it's not going to save that much money because there's so many ways around the minimum markup now. The minimum markup is where you have to charge a certain amount for gasoline. So it's not that that all of their ideas are bad, and I have a lot of sympathy for the Assembly Republicans because I think they're just trying to craft something here that they can get past the governor and say that they didn't increase the gas tax, because technically what they do is they lower the gas tax, but then they apply the sales tax to gasoline, which would amount to a 12-cent increase, whereas lowering the gas tax would have reduced it by a nickel. So in the end, you're raising it anyway. So I just think what needs to happen here is just something simple. And just, we need more money for roads. We haven't been raising more money for roads in more than a decade. Let's just bump up the gas tax a bit, like so many other states, including states run by Republicans, have done. Iowa raised their gas tax by a dime a gallon.
Talking to Scott Milford from the Wisconsin State Journal. He's the editorial page editor there. The editorial team just recently published an editorial called Just Raise the Gas Tax Already. Scott, we heard from Jerry on Facebook who says, wouldn't increasing the gas tax hurt poorer people who can't afford more fuel-efficient vehicles? So would this be, in effect, a regressive tax?
Well, yes, it is a regressive tax in that everybody pays the same amount. Now, if you drive a big gas guzzler, you pay more. And I think if that was a big concern, there have been proposals on the table from some of the governor's own task forces that you could do other things. Like you could, if you're concerned about that, you could, for example, charge a higher registration fee. By the way, we have the lowest registration fee, annual fee for a vehicle in the Midwest. You could charge a higher registration fee for, say, a luxury vehicle. You could do something like that if you wanted to make it more progressive. But I think ultimately, people who drive on the roads have to pay for the roads. And the simplest way to do that is a gas tax. Now, maybe at some point here we move to more of a mileage tax, because if you, based on how far you go, and that's something the task force that the governor created also had recommended and which he ignored. Because then if you have electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles, they're helping pay for the road too.
Now, once upon a time, Scott, the gas tax was indexed. Inflation went up. The gas tax went up automatically. A little more complicated than that, but that was the gist. Nobody had to make a vote on it, which I guess made it politically savory or sound, but that was voted out of existence. Should we go back to that?
I wouldn't be opposed to it. I think there was some argument that it was automatically making our tax higher and higher, and we were getting to the point there where it went up every year with inflation, and pretty soon Wisconsin's gas tax is one of the highest in the nation. Now that we've frozen it for more than a decade, we have fallen, and we're not the highest in the nation. And in fact, if you include states that have sales tax applied to their gas, we're about the middle of the pack for the Midwest. So, yeah, I think that would remove a lot of the politics from it, and you'd have this steady increase with inflation to pay for roads. I wouldn't be opposed to that.
Scott, some people have said, hey, we don't have a road funding problem. We have a road building problem. Our eyes are bigger than our stomach. We've planned on too many projects, more than we need, and that's why we can't pay for it. Do you buy that?
Well, if we do, then why do they keep proposing all of these projects? I mean, the governor in each of his last two budgets has borrowed almost $1 billion in each of those budgets. So clearly he thinks we need better roads. And how has he gotten the money to pay for them? He's borrowed largely. And his latest plan, which he's pushing for, is, well, let's take more money from the general fund. But when you take, he also wants to take more money from the general fund to pay for schools. So if you start taking money from income and sales taxes to pay for roads, now you're competing. Roads are now competing with schools for money. And you can't have it both ways. You can't, you know, he's going to increase more money for schools, but take more money out of that funding stream for roads, that contradicts. So I just think it's really not that hard to increase the gas tax, but for whatever reason, the governor thinks politically he's on the right side with the voters. I don't think he is. If you look at polls, voters really don't want to pay more for anything. But I think increasingly, as our roads get worse and worse, voters are saying, I'm willing to pay a little bit more. And in a news story we had Sunday, it seemed like the governor was hinting at that.
So do you think that the political will could be there to, as you say in the editorial, raise the gas tax already?
Well, I think the governor's down this road that he would veto it. So then the question is, which John Nygren, who is the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, essentially the budget committee, he had sort of, this was last year, mentioned the word override, like maybe they could override a veto of the governor. The thing is Wisconsin's legislature has not override a veto in more than 30 years. Governors are very powerful. And when the same party controls the legislature as the governor's office, they're even more resistant to doing that. But I think if there was going to be the political will, it would come out of the assembly, and they would just say, we've had enough. We're just going to put some reasonable, modest fee increases here in the budget. And if you veto it, Governor, we'll try to override. But I have to acknowledge that would be very difficult.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure.
We've been talking to Scott Milford, Wisconsin State Journal editorial page editor. You can find a link to the editorial, "Just Raise the Gas Tax Already," on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to a very famous lullaby, Rockabye Baby. This lullaby may have seemed like it's been around forever, but how long have lullabies really been around?
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to share a new theory on how lullabies evolved. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us every month to share the latest and coolest news in science. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello and happy science.
So lullabies, infant-directed songs, I think scientists call them. I like the sound of that better. Where do lullabies come from?
Well, that is the great question. And, you know, this one team earlier this year came out with actually the first formal theory. If you can believe it, it's taken this long to even get our first formal theory. But basically, lullabies arose out of an arms race.
That doesn't sound very warm and nurturing, Gemma, when arms race between who? The infants and the moms, right?
Yeah, the moms who were their traditional caregivers. And it all goes back to that period when humans and our human ancestors were really becoming fully bipedal. Just to be fully bipedal, pelvic changes happened. The bones narrowed. It limited the size of the infant at the time of the birth. So humans, all of us, are kind of born in a state of prematurity, believe it or not. But if you think about other animals like horses and cows, right after they're born, they're up and walking. But humans need this extended period of really hands-on care after birth when they're babies. So basically, you've got the baby, you've got the mom, again, the traditional caregiver, and you've also got predators, the need to find shelter, the need to find food, the need to take care of other babies and children you may have running around. So basically, the mother, even though the baby still needs the care, the mother at some point has to put the baby down and deal with some of the other things she's got going on in her life. I'm sure moms can today still relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you have to design something. Something has to evolve. Let's put it that way. Something has to evolve that the mother, traditional caregiver, can reassure the baby, yes, I'm really paying attention to you, even though I'm not holding you at this instant. And the baby, as young and, you know, not exactly cognitively advanced as it is, it needs to be able to gauge the authenticity of that attention. Are you really paying attention to me or what? And that's basically how lullabies evolved. You can, you know, make a noise that the baby will appreciate as, okay, that noise means you're paying attention to me. But the more complex the noise you make, the more sure that baby is, okay, you're really paying attention to me, so I can stop crying. So basically, it's all about babies demanding as much attention as possible and caregivers giving that attention while still making sure they can do other stuff at the same time.
As I understand that, this is kind of a hypothesis about how we evolved, but the researchers have some ideas on how to put it to the test. How would they do that?
Yeah, actually, the same research team is they're planning a bunch of experiments to test the validity of their theory. Some of them will be involved with actual babies, you know, singing lullabies to babies and gauging different elements of their response to the sounds. But also there are some genetic conditions out there that actually affect how a person perceives song being sung to them and infant-directed songs, which are the slower and repetitive songs that we think of as lullabies. And basically there are some conditions out there where even into adolescence and adulthood, the people with these conditions respond differently to music and to sound. So they're already doing some work with them, with these folks, and just testing their responses and seeing if it supports their theory.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, getting the latest in cool science news. Just talked there about lullabies. And now we're going to talk about play, Gemma, because when you look at the animal kingdom, And we think of examples of animals that seem playful. I think of things like river otters and monkeys and dogs and cats, too. But these are all mammals. It sounds as though there's new research coming in that it's not play isn't just limited to mammals anymore. We've got frolicking spiders and octopi. What's going on with these different types of animals?
Well, the interesting thing, it's really only been a decade or so that researchers have agreed that, yeah, things that are not mammals really do play. And basically, it arose when a few isolated experiments, for example, a team put these unused old pill bottles into an aquarium with octopuses and saw that the octopuses would kind of jet them back and forth and play. There was another experiment with spiders where the spiders appeared to be almost getting it on, but not quite, and they would repeat this activity over and over again. And a bunch of different experiments like that, they realized that, hey, play is not limited to mammals, so how do we know if a non-mammal is playing, and why are they playing? And that research has really only started about a decade ago.
It sounds like a lot of the research was looking at something that looked like play in a gecko or something like that,
yeah,
and trying to prove that it wasn't really play because we didn't think that non-mammals played.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for a long time, we know it. Humans are kind of exceptionalists. We like to think, oh, we're the only ones who do this. And of course, we've broadened that a little bit to the whole mammals area, saying, oh, okay, puppies play, bear cubs play, but only mammals play. You know, it's kind of our superiority complex that we've got going on. But, you know, the amount of evidence is just overwhelming. And one huge boost to studying non-mammal play has been technology, because now researchers are able to record animals, and in the case of a turtle that was playing, they recorded him, what they thought, they weren't sure, he was kind of pushing a ball around, weren't sure what was going on, but then they sped it up to the speed that, say, a dog might play, and they're like, oh my gosh, he is playing just like a dog would play. So with a video, they're able much, much better to see that these animals are actually, you know, cavorting.
So, Gemma, what is the scientific definition of cavorting or play in this case?
Well, basically, there are a few different definitions. They agree with each other, but play is basically something that's voluntary, something that's repeated several times. It's not just a one-off. It does not have an obvious function, and it differs from regular functional behavior. And it's also, you see it in healthy animals that aren't stressed. And so those are really kind of the criteria, basically, for play, observing play. And, you know, there's some really important reasons for play. For example, one experiment done on rats shows that play actually changes the brain. It affects the development of the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for complex thoughts and regulating emotions. And actually, episodes of play enhanced younger rats' neural plasticity, which is a fancy way of saying that as they got older, their brains were just more flexible. They had better, you know, reaction to their surroundings and environment and different situations as they arose, because they had this great neural plasticity that seems to be the result of play when they were younger.
What's getting me here? I get octopus, sure. I could see an octopus playing. Geckos, okay. Yeah, turtle, slow motion play. Spiders? I think of spiders as being all business. Right? I mean, and they
you
play,
and
you're telling
Americans.
Me.
Were you not listening to Gemma's story?
Well, I heard, but I don't know. I'm kind of baffled by the concept of a spider playing.
Well, the one that really baffled me was the experiment on wasps. Mm. These young paper wasps were noted just kind of like play fighting. Like they were biting each other, but then kind of licking each other. And, you know, kind of as you've seen two dogs kind of rolling around just having fun. But, yeah, spiders do play. And the reason we know that at least one species of spider plays is because I mentioned that they do this kind of like almost getting it on repeatedly, where they're just kind of like fooling around, if you want to say. We know it's play because if they were doing it for real, the male would have a 30% chance of getting eaten alive. So that, you know, when they're playing, they don't do that. So they're not all business all the time.
There you go. Thanks for keeping it clean there, Gemma.
I try.
All right, well, let's move on to swamps now. You wrote a feature this month called 20 Things You Didn't Know About Swamps. Gemma, what don't we know about swamps?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I think most people just think of swamps as these, like, yucky, buggy places that you want to avoid, especially when you're, like, hiking, you know. But they're actually fascinating ecosystems. And there's so much that's cool about swamps. But even if you never go near a swamp, you should thank them. Because even though they comprise about 5 to 8% of the planet's land surface, they are holding about 30% of Earth's stored carbon, which is great. They're great at carbon sequestration, which is really important in this age of climate change. And also, you know, they have a lot of other bonuses, too. Everything from in the years of the Underground Railroad, a lot of African Americans fleeing slavery actually settled in the Great Dismal Swamp on the Virginia-North Carolina border. And, you know, it was not the most pleasant place to live, but they were safe there and they were able to have, you know, full lives and actually do farming and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, the other thing about swamps is a lot of carnivorous plants actually evolved to live in a swamp and take advantage of the fact that they have really poor nutrition in the soil. And I know that sounds weird, but they actually figured out a way to adapt to living in a swamp. So there are a zillion reasons, not just 20 things you didn't know about swamps, but a zillion reasons. And they're fascinating places.
And briefly, Gemma, what makes a swamp a swamp?
What makes a swamp a swamp? Basically, swamps, mires, marshes, they are all wetlands. And wetlands is any land where the water table is at or near the surface, and the level of water saturation in the ground determines the flora and the fauna and the kind of soil that is in that ecological environment.
We'll leave it there for now. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to share some of the coolest news from the world of science.
Have you ever noticed that when you try to accomplish a task and you focus more and more, it sometimes gets harder to accomplish, or that you have some of your best breakthroughs when you're spacing out a little?
Our next guest says that sometimes the key to new insights, getting creative, or getting mentally unstuck is to let your mind wander or get distracted.
Dr. Srini Pillai joins us now. He's a neuroscientist and the author of the new book, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try, Unlock the Power of the Unfocused Mind. Srini, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Veronica. Appreciate it.
Well, you start your book telling the story of a night ride. There's a scientist in the car. He's a little sleepy. His girlfriend's nodding off, and he's kind of free associating, and doing so, he comes up with something new. Can you tell us that story and how that's an example of what you're talking about?
Sure. The book starts with the story of Carrie Banks Mullis, who's a biochemist who discovered polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, which is a way of actually just replicating some genes. And it's really influenced all of modern biology in a very significant way. And that story is a story of his driving from Berkeley to Mendocino, you know, essentially not necessarily focusing on anything. And then all of a sudden, his mind starts creating these lurid blue and pink images, and he starts putting two and two together, and it's in the state of unfocus that he's able to come up and with this eureka experience that leads to his big discovery, which eventually led to his getting the Nobel Prize. And the reason I started the book with that story is I wanted to just emphasize how a lot of times some of our greatest moments come at times of unfocus. Yet so many people today live such pressured lives with back-to-back scheduling that there's no time for this unfocus in their lives. It's usually focus, 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 fatigue. And if they are unfocused, then they're just completely lost to the world. And what I wanted to say was that sometimes it's really valuable to build unfocus into the middle of your day or even close to the beginning of your day. And in the case of Carrie Banks Mullis, that was something that actually paid off.
And your own story is a case in point here, especially if you go back to the days when you were a student and you were one of those focus, focus, focus guys, and then it all kind of fell apart. What happened?
Yeah, it did. So, you know, when you focus excessively, what happens is it drains on what we call the prefrontal cortex or the thinking brain. And as a result of that, all of that energy is actually wasted, and you're not really able to concentrate and retain memories. So certainly early on in medical school, in my second year when I was learning sort of how to memorize bones and nerves and arteries. I actually found myself studying sort of, you know, for many, many, many hours. And despite the fact that I was studying so hard, I wasn't getting the results that I wanted. And so I started to build unfocus into my day. I started to do things like work for 45 minutes and take 15-minute breaks. I started to take naps when I needed them. At that point, I even started a meditation practice against my will. Someone had mentioned it to me, and I thought, oh, this sounds sort of crazy. But then someone said, well, you know, if you're a scientist, why don't you try it out and see if it works? So I said, okay, I'll try that out. And little by little, I started to change my lifestyle so that there were unfocused elements built into my day. And I deliberately took time off on certain weekends just to completely let go of this intensity of working. And paradoxically, building unfocus into my day really escalated my results. And so I was, you know, able to get to the top of the class and stay there with those results. Although I'll have to say that when I went into my residency at Harvard, I made the same mistake. You know, I wanted to do really well, so I worked really hard and I stayed in the units all day. And when I got my first bit of feedback, they called me in and they said, listen, we love what you're doing. We're obviously, your knowledge base is obviously ahead of everybody else, but we're really worried about you. And that really caught me off guard because I thought, you know, what are you worried about? I've been here every day. I go to every class. And they said, well, that's precisely the problem. We don't see you going off to the pond in the summer. We don't see you sitting on the park benches. And the whole point about Harvard is that we're here to help you cultivate your mind, not to make you into a memory machine. And so that really was something that changed, that particular phraseology was something that changed my thinking about this, because I recognized that so many people spend so much of their time just doing things and working like machines and in automated mode. And in a modern world where, you know, to tell the truth, logic and automation is becoming a commodity, robots are actually taking over a lot of jobs, we actually need to learn how to tap into our deepest authenticity and our humanity, and the unfocused, turning on the unfocused circuits in the brain is what will do that.
Well, I think that in our society, as you were saying, it seems like a virtue to focus and to try to gain laser-like, you know, undisturbable focus, and that those periods that you're talking about, sitting on a bench, listening to music, that fallow time seems, in a way, time wasted. So why are you saying that this is, in a way, the most fertile time?
Well, for a lot of different reasons. Firstly, I want to emphasize that it's not about only unfocusing, and I'm certainly not suggesting distraction. I think that focus is an essential competency. I think without focus, it's very hard to stay on task. It's very hard to get stuff done. The reason I wrote the book on unfocus is that people are aware of focus, but they're overdoing it with focus. They're not really building in unfocused times. And so if you think about some of the disadvantages of focus, there are a few. So the first is, you know, there was one study, for example, that where they took two groups of people and they had them look at videos. And they had one group focus intensely on the video, and they had the other group just look at the video as usual. And after that, they gave them a moral dilemma in which they had to save some people. And they found that the people who were in the focus group had no interest in participating, whereas the people in the unfocused group were actually interested in participating and helping people out. And then when they fed the people in the focus group glucose, they started to become more interested in helping out, indicating that it was not that they were intrinsically negative or intrinsically unhelpful, but that focus depletes your brain so much that by the end of the day, you don't really want to listen to anybody else's problems or even think about anybody else's problems. So one big disadvantage of over-focusing is draining your thinking brain and losing a sense of empathy. I think another example that I talk about in the book is the idea that focus can actually make you lose sight of what's going on in the periphery. So some businesses have actually lost out to competitors, and they've lost out on developing products because they've been too focused. You know, Rosabeth Moss Kanter, who's at Harvard Business School, has pointed out there was a point at which Gillette had a toothbrush division and they had a battery division, and they worked incredibly well, and their profits were increasing, and they were doing really well. But they were late to the market with electric toothbrushes because no one had unfocused from those very focused divisions within the company. So focus does have a downside, and if we're not aware of that, you know, even in the simple example of dating someone, you know, if you've got just your nose, sort of your head buried in the sand, and you're dating someone, you don't notice that they're displeased, or you don't notice that other people are taking notice of them, you could easily lose someone as well. So it's not just in complex business operations, but in our day-to-day lives, I think we need to reawaken unfocused, and we need to recognize that focus on its own doesn't really cut it.
We're speaking with Dr. Srini Pillay right now. He's a neuroscientist and the author of the new book, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try, Unlock the Power of the Unfocused Mind. And Dr. Pillay, what happens in the unfocused mind that's so special? I know you say it acts as a bridge and helps the others be more efficient, but what's actually happening in the brain?
Well, I'll use a metaphor. So when you're focused, then in your brain, focus acts a little bit like a fork. So the parts of you that show up are all the very sort of concrete parts of you, you know, like whether you think you're male or female, or whether you think you are, you know, what your age is or what your specific work is. These are all the very concrete and obvious parts of yourself. But when you unfocus, your brain metaphorically calls for other silverware. It calls for a spoon so that you can pick up, it can pick up all the delicious melange of flavors of your identity. So all of a sudden, as part of your identity circuits, as part of the self that is showing up to your everyday work, you have the scent of your grandmother. And then there are chopsticks, which are making connections, as I said, across the brain, thereby allowing you to see how you can come up with more innovative and creative ideas. And then there are things like that are equivalent to marrow spoons, which go into the nooks and crannies and are able to pick out memories that focus would never be able to pick out. So you look at situation A, where you only have focus, and the you that shows up to your day is the you with all the concrete parts of yourself. But when you have unfocus, it stimulates the brain circuitry so that the part of yourself that shows up is this complex part with many more puzzle pieces, and as a result, you feel more coherent, more aligned, and more engaged with your work. And at a functional level, what the unfocused circuits are doing is they're not only increasing your ability to feel present, they are also doing a number of other things. One of the other things they do is something we call mentalizing. And simply what that means is something like mind reading. So in order to understand and anticipate what other people are feeling, our brains are wired to try to anticipate what that is. And so in an unfocused state, one can actually be much better prepared to understand what that is. In addition to that, the brain also starts acting as a predictor organ. In fact, in many scientific articles, people refer to this as the brain becoming a crystal ball. So people like Ray Kurzweil, for example, futurists, investors who are very good at coming up with things over and over again, are able to tap into this unfocused circuit to activate this prediction circuitry. And then there's innovation or making connections. So prediction, innovation, picking up old memories, accentuating a sense of self, these are all really important faculties that a lot of people don't tap into because they don't build unfocused times into their day.
We're speaking right now with Dr. Srini Pillay. He's a neuroscientist and the author of the new book, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try, Unlock the Power of the Unfocused Mind. And he's with us now to talk about the book and how we can get more creative or get more work done on difficult problems by focusing less.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you do this? Do you build in some unstructured time into your otherwise busy day? Does it help you? Does it help you solve problems? Have you done this in school, in college, at work, you name it? Do you have questions about how this works? And are there specific things you do to take that unfocused time, maybe actually literally doodling, for example, or tinkering with something, and then ideas come to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit. Stay with us on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking with Dr. Srini Pillay about how doing seemingly mindless tasks like going for a walk, listening to music, doodling can actually be good for the brain and make you more productive and creative. He has a new book out right now. It's called Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try, Unlock the Power of the Unfocused Mind.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this something you do? Do you build in this unfocused time in your workday, in your school day? Does it help you? How does it help you? What do you come up with? And do you have questions about how to actually put this into practice? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first phone call right now. We have Galen on the line in Duluth, Minnesota. Galen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good.
What did you want to share?
Well, I was just sharing that I'm a musician, so I write songs and sing them. And a lot of the songs that I write, at least the first verse or the chorus will come to me in a really unstructured time, like in the shower or taking a nap or riding in a car. And so I definitely think all sorts of creative problems are solved that way. So I just think it's interesting that you're talking about that for science, because I think it applies to art especially.
Right. And, Galen, thank you for that. And that's something you agree with, Dr. Pillay. You see a lot of parallels in music and the way the brain works. Can you talk about some of those?
Absolutely. Yeah, but thanks so much for sharing that, Galen. Yeah, I think the musical process does involve a combination of focus and unfocus, and I think a lot of spontaneous ideas and original ideas come from a combination of thoughts that occur when you are in the shower or you're daydreaming in a particular way or doodling. Really, in any of those particular states, you activate this unfocused network and original ideas are recombined, coming up with something that is new. And so musical thought, I think, is a great example of that. I think another context in which this occurs in music is with jazz musicians, because a lot of time people sort of think not just about the musical composition, but they think, you know, how is it that jazz musicians can anticipate what the next person is going to be playing? And with jazz musicians, it's this prediction circuitry that gets activated, and it gets activated because you have to move between focusing on what you're playing and then unfocusing enough to be able to predict what the next musician is going to be playing.
How can we simulate that in our own daily lives, that we get comfortable toggling back and forth between those two kind of brain functions and states?
Well, in a number of different ways. You know, to make this easier, you know, for a particular period for this book, I'm actually also offering an app called the Tinker Table, and this is a free app that comes along with the book, which actually allows you to automatically schedule in one of the techniques or more of the techniques in the book that will help you automatically protect time for as long as you want, for as many days as you want. So to help you do that automatically, I think the app is great. I also think there's a quick start guide that helps you figure out when in your day you might want to actually schedule one of these things in. But just to get into it a little bit more detail, what is one of those things that you could be doing to toggle back and forth? Well, let's talk about daydreaming. So for the longest time, Matthew Killingsworth and his colleagues have found that daydreaming in general is not that helpful. When you slip into a daydream, it's a little like falling off a cliff. It's not helpful. When you have daydreaming that involves constant rumination, where you're thinking about maybe a few indiscretions because you've had a few more drinks than you wanted to the night before, that's also not helpful. But there is a type of daydreaming studied by Jerome Singer since the 1950s called positive constructive daydreaming. And there are three things only that you need to remember to initiate this kind of daydreaming so that it increases your creativity. So if, for example, you're wanting to compose some music but you feel like you're a little stuck, or you're writing and you're having some writer's block, you can schedule 15 minutes. The first thing is schedule it in deliberately. Secondly, do it when you are doing something low-key, like gardening or like surfing the net, so that it doesn't require a ton of different, it doesn't require a ton of effort. Or you can be knitting in your office. So anything that's a low-key activity, because studies have shown that if you're doing something intensely engaged, obviously it's hard to daydream, but also if you're doing nothing, it's not as effective as when you're doing something that's low-key. And then the third thing that Jerome Singer said was, when you're starting this daydream, it's going to be hard for you to actually remove your perception on what you're focusing on, your email or your computer or anything outside of you, and move this perception inward. And the way you initiate this is you use what he called a playful or wishful image. So you can think of yourself lying on a yacht, or you can think of yourself running through the woods with a dog, or you can think of yourself going for a walk. Whatever it is you're thinking about, it needs to be playful or wishful. And so planning it, doing it playfully or wishfully, and then allowing your perception to turn inwards during a low-key activity will get you into this PCD, or positive constructive daydreaming state. Now, a lot of people say, you know, it's hard to stay in the daydream. Sometimes you feel a little scared that your mind is just wandering and it's just like something on the loose. But what brain studies have shown is that the brain's guiding apparatus, the lateral prefrontal cortex, is actually there guiding your wandering mind toward things that are actually of relevance and significance to you. So even though on the outside or on the surface it may seem like your mind is just randomly creating images, it's actually very difficult for your mind to be that random or chaotic. Your brain will guide it towards things of relevance. And so I would suggest that, number one, positive constructive daydreaming is a great way to actually lose yourself in the interior spaces of your mind. I think another technique is doodling. So studies have shown that doodling can improve memory by 29%, which, you know, sounds counterintuitive because everybody's always telling kids at school, you know, stop doing that, pay attention. But now we know that when you doodle, what you're doing is two things. You are actually keeping your mind circling in a particular area so that it's not wandering too far away. And the second thing that you're doing is you're activating your unconscious so that there are many more mechanisms that can actually absorb memory that come to the fore. It's a little bit like, you know, a sponge that is loose is able to absorb things more effectively, whereas a sponge that is tight, it's very hard to absorb things with a sponge like that.
We're talking right now with Dr. Srini Pillay, neuroscientist and author of Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try, Unlock the Power of the Unfocused Mind. And Galen, thank you for that call and for bringing up music. And let's take another call now from Eric at Cuba City High School. Eric, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
I had a question. I'm a teacher at Cuba City High School, and I am wondering for my high school students, how frequently should I have something like this built into my curriculum? How frequently should I give them that break, and for how long?
Eric, thanks. And what do you think, Dr. Pillay?
So I don't think we have any definitive research in this, and I would suggest trying out different methods that are in the Quick Start Guide. But as a general idea, I think what I would do is identify when you see the biggest slumps. And I think most people would say mid-morning, directly after lunch, and then mid-afternoon. And so if you think of those three times, if you build in periods of approximately 10 to 15 minutes, you can actually really rejuvenate the brain significantly with particular goals in mind. So for example, if you just want them to be clearer so that they're able to attend and they're able to focus more effectively, 10 minutes of napping can be effective. But if you want them to work in a creative project, then studies show that 90 minutes of napping is actually much more effective. So I would say approximately three times a day, 10 to 15 minutes. But if you want to actually initiate a full-scale, you know, creativity idea, then building that into their schedule for about 90 minutes seems like a risk, but it'll probably get them going. I will say that as part of the book, I actually visited a school called Brightworks in San Francisco, which has a summer tinkering school. And they're quite remarkable because they don't, you know, this is a school I think my parents would never have sent me to. They don't do any focused math or any language skills. But by the fifth grade, students are two full grades above the national average because they do things like they give them a theme like nails, and then one person makes a chair, another person might write a screenplay. There are students from the ages of like 9 to 15 in the same class. They call them bands. So it depends how experimental you want to be. But if it's a regular school and you're trying to figure out curriculum, I think three times a day for 10 to 15 minutes would be a great way to start.
Well, Eric, good luck to you. I hope that works out. And we're out of time, Dr. Srini. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Dr. Srini Pillay, neuroscientist and the author of his new book, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try, Unlock the Power of the Unfocused Mind. He was with us today to talk about why letting our minds wander and be a little bit unfocused can help with accomplishing tasks or achieving goals. And you can let us know how you might do this. Do you use it in music? Do you use it in education? Maybe in your day-to-day life when you want to refresh and hit that reset button. Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
Bye. That's the sound of the classic video game Donkey Kong, one of the newest members of the World Video Game Hall of Fame.
That's right. Donkey Kong was honored along with games from Pokemon, Halo, and Street Fighter franchises. Past inductees include Space Invaders, The Sims, Pac-Man, Doom, and, of course, Pong. That's a game that started it all.
All right, let's talk Donkey Kong a little bit. It was designed in 1981. It was hitting the arcades around the same time I was hitting the arcades.
Same here.
I was never any good at Donkey Kong. I don't know. I may have cleared the first level once or twice.
Same here. It was a difficult game, but do you remember how satisfying it was when you were able to jump over the barrels?
Yeah.
It felt pretty good.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But it was, that was one, okay, there's like a graph I could have made, you know, how much I wanted to get the game done, how difficult it was, and how willing I was to spend the quarters it took to do that. And Donkey Kong, it was tough enough, and I died early enough that my quarters started going to other machines pretty
quick. Right, so that's a complicated equation. For me, that equation went out best with Galaga. That is my game.
You are the Galaga star.
Right.
We acknowledge
Not
this.
So much Donkey Kong, but Galaga and Burger Time was another one. It's a little similar, I feel like, to Donkey Kong, but it's got some tweaks and burgers.
And, of course, Donkey Kong gave us Mario and the franchise and all the games there. So it's a long Hall of Fame history. This is Central Time.